Welcome to Green Planet, Blue Planet. I'm here today with Ted Rau, author of a book called Sociocracy. Ted, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited for this conversation with you to learn about, you know, different forms of group decision making, to understand more about sociocracy, what it is, what it isn't. Where do you want to start? I know this is a depth of knowledge that we can dive into.
Well, let's start with what sociocracy is, with then also comment on what it's not. Sociocracy is a governance method, and typically that doesn't really get people's attention because we think of governance as something kind of far away from us, right? And kind of boring and dusty and eh. And I was like that too. And now I'm super, super excited about governance because I see it really as the processes and methods that tie us together as humans when we want to work together and also connect us to our purpose, right? Our mission, the thing that we do. So if we think about the people that we work with and the thing that we want to do as both things that we care about, governance is what connects all of them. And then all of a sudden it becomes really, really important and really close to our heart as well. So as a governance method, sociocracy has to do different things. One is any governance method needs to provide a method of decision making. Unless you say the boss decides, then you don't need that. Then you can just do whatever the boss does. But if you want to decide as a group, you have to find a way of what that means. Like, for example, we can say a decision is made by a group if we all vote and 51% say yes. Or we could say a decision is made by this group when everybody agrees. Or, which is what we do in sociocracy, a decision is made if nobody in the group objects. That's called consent decision making. So it comes with a decision making method so groups can choose what they want to do. And then the second piece that a governance method needs to do is to provide some sort of framework on how we can decide who decides what. Because if we decide everything together, right, imagine a group of 150 people deciding everything together, we would go completely insane. So that doesn't seem to be viable. It's just not an option. So that's why we need to somehow decide together, ideally, who decides what. And how that is done in sociocracy is that we, if we have a circle, we call that a team that makes decisions on a certain area because they work in that certain area, they can then form subcircles like in a fractal pattern, right? So they might decide, oh, we need a subcircle in this. And now we empower them to make decisions on that and take care of that. And they kind of form it like a, I imagine it as something that is budding out. So now we have a mechanism by which we can bud out and transfer and power and empower other groups to make decisions. And all of that is really built around the principle that we want organizations where those who do stuff also decide. We don't want that separation between those who decide, the managers, and then the workers on the other side. We want it to be integrated and together because then decisions are really well informed and people are empowered. And ideally in small groups. So those are some of the design principles and thoughts that flow into it.
Yeah, I like this, what you just said there. If we had 150 people and all of them had to come to a decision together every single time, it would probably not be viable, right? So understanding who gets to decide what in, you know, whatever group you find yourself in, that is very much based on the real life experience I've been making with organizations and teams and groups. And, you know, there's something right there. I'd love to follow that train of thought a little bit. I also want to frame it a bit more. So I know you've had some, you know, cross-pollination with the Presencing Institute in the past and, you know, Theory U and the work of Otto Scharner, which is all about kind of, you know, presencing and understanding we are arriving in a full state of presence and listening. And then I think also holacracy is a topic that maybe a lot of people know about. Like, where would you frame those two ideas and ideologies in relationship with sociocracy?
Sure. So as its function, sociocracy and holacracy do exactly the same thing. So kind of if you look at, you know, what are the pieces of the puzzle that I need to run an organization or to show up in my life, sociocracy and holacracy occupy the same spot. And actually, Holacracy was also heavily built on Sociocracy. So it is, for those who know one or the other, they look at the other one and go like, oh, that's so similar, you know? So they are very, very close to each other. There are a few differences that there's of course a lot of discussion, as it always is if one goes into a community, you know, like they go all out on discussing the differences. That's not maybe so interesting to go into, and there's stuff written about that if people care about it. What I'm more interested in talking about right now is the kind of what's the relationship between tools like Theory U and Sociocracy, because I'm very interested about that in general right now. And here's a little bit of a super simplified version of it. But to me, Sociocracy is the doing mode of an organization, and things like Theory U are the being mode of an organization. And of course, ideally, they should inform each other, right? Like, if we sense into what's happening, it should be based on real life experience and not just some kind of judgment on what probably is happening. You know, that's what managers do if they have no clue what's actually happening, right? So we don't want to have an organization where the managers sense into the future, right? And the workers are completely cut off from that. So it has to be integrated. And then, of course, the flip side is also true. We want circles in a sociocratic system, so working teams, not just to do and never pause to think and really tune in of like, wait, what is actually happening? Where do we see this is all going, and what kind of future do we want to have? So, and I think that combination, so I see in general, I see Sociocracy as just one of the building blocks. Like, I would never say, oh, Sociocracy is going to fix all the problems you can probably have. I think it's a super potent and powerful and beautifully brilliant tool for what it does. But we need to connect it with other things to have a sort of regenerative, I don't know, meta ecosystem kind of a thing. Because things like Theory U or things like nonviolent communication and any kind of anti-oppression work, they all go together into this big kind of ecosystem. Mm.
You touched on it. You said it's one is the being mode of a group or organization or a team, and the other is the doing mode of a group, organization, or team. I find this interesting. This is a good kind of label to, I think, dive deeper. You know, we're human beings, right? There's no doing in the word human being, but the word being is in the description, human being. But then maybe the human part is the doing part, right? Like, let's just say there's doing and being in all of our lives. And I think the classical world we kind of are, most of us are just thrown into it, born into it, and have to, you know, somehow find our path. There is an overemphasis on doing. You know, it's pretty obvious, so we don't need to necessarily digress into this. How do you see the interplay of being and doing through just an actual governance system, you know, and governance obviously would also be something you said this at the very beginning, that an organization needs to choose. Because of course, if you as a team say, no, this is the one guy or the one lady that decides, that is also a way to make group decisions by trusting the one person that is the leader for a certain topic. But coming back into the difference of being and doing, how do you see this actually supporting people in real life with those real situations we go through, where sometimes being needs to take the front seat and very often it can't at this point?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. So again, this is something that I'm very actively thinking about, kind of the next book project on the horizon to me is about that. And for me, what I think about it right now is that this dualism that I introduced and you kind of picked up on, I'm wondering how much it serves us. That's just a kind of an active question of mine right now, because what I'd be most interested in is a deep, and I mean really, really deep, integration of the two, right? Because we're talking about organizations, let's just play with it on organizations for a moment. But I think it's the same pattern transfers into all kinds of other things. So I kind of built that antagonistic relationship between managers and workers, right? Because we're all familiar with it. So that would be kind of thinking and planning, right? And then doing. Unfortunately, in a lot of being, I agree with you on that one very much. But what Sociocracy does, and that's really interesting, is that, again, it connects the people, or it makes the same the people who do work in a particular area and make decisions there. So what we're doing is we're basically putting the being with something and thinking about and reflecting and kind of sensing into together into kind of the more grassroots level, so it can happen in all the different places. So that is a deep integration just structurally in how it happens, right? That you don't separate those two out. So that's a trail I'm following out of what does that mean and how can that even be more closely related, like an almost interpenetrating of those, you know, because ultimately what sociocracy is trying to do and what I'm really also after is how can we mimic the interconnectedness in all the different ways? And that is one of the avenues on which that can, or one of the axes on that in which that can happen. There's another thing I want to bring up for that, and that is, so just because listeners might know that, so one of the most known patterns that are used in sociocracy are rounds that people also know from many other places. So the round, just a simple thing that we talk one by one by one by one, right? So instead of into this, like as soon as people break rounds, you can actually tell they're arguing against each other. If we have that back and forth, it typically polarizes more, right? Because I say, but this and this and that, and you say, but this and this and that, right? So, and instead what we do is we try to disperse that energy and hold it more collectively by doing rounds. And you can really observe that, how that changes the energy. And many people have reported back that just doing rounds changed the way they were thinking about it. So it allows for people to tune into what's there more. Like when I'm in groups, especially in person, but also somewhat on Zoom, what happens is that it almost seems more like everybody is kind of contributing, like, you know, bringing the offering into the middle of the circle instead of me arguing against another person. And then, and that speaks again to the integration between being and doing, what we can reach is that those who do things together can also be healing places for each other. They can just be with each other and be more witness to each other in what they're wanting and seeing and so on. So that's another crazy fantasy of mine, of just what if organizations could be places for healing themselves, not just for doing.
Yeah, I mean, that is somewhat of a crazy fantasy in, you know, in one way of saying it, but it also could be, you know, the way that the world in general works is that we allow each other to, you know, rest and recover and heal or also transform wherever we might get stuck as individuals or groups. And in group work, it's actually extremely important, right? If we get stuck, if it's on a topic or a problem, we need to often just change the perspective. And from a new perspective, the solution kind of, you know, becomes quite easy to spot. I want to dive onto something here that's my own experience in, you know, being a student of Theory U, being a student of nonviolent communication, definitely following Holacracy, and super excited to have you on, Ted, with the topic of sociocracy. I love these governance systems or, you know, methodologies to bring in healthy communication. I also sometimes make the experience that if it is too theoretical and it is just like, this is the way, it's in the book, right? We're kind of missing the point of how real humans feel and real humans share. So I like what you said with the rounds. It does revolutionize any circle I've ever been in when you follow it. To only talk in rounds, though, I think ever would maybe also be exhausting in a different way, right? So how do you keep the balance between both what people know and what they're used to, as well as what is the ideal in maybe a very theoretical approach, and then, you know, just real life? The real way people show up, which can be challenging, but can also be beautiful, right?
Yeah, and real life is so rich, right? And has so many things in it. I mean, there is, for example, just to name a few things that pop into my head about that are very real. Of let's say we have the expectation of meeting that ideal of always talking in rounds and hearing everybody. What will get in our way, of course, is just people's internal stuff. You know, they might get stuck on something and then they're not following anymore. There is urgency, like what if we don't have time for a round right now, we need to do something within the next 5 minutes. So there are they're just factors of real life that get in the way. And I think one has to, any system has to plan for that. One thing that really has showed up for me in the last year in particular is that, in a way, what we do this with this work of sociocracy is we do a lot of things at once. We kind of support people in their healing from power over systems and being able, because a lot of that gets stirred up if they learn about sociocracy. So that comes with a package of teaching a new system, is that you have to deal with the crap from the old. So the other thing that we teach is even teach what governance is, like kind of more the agency piece and then sociocracy and so on. But another piece that we're teaching, and that's the hardest, I would say, that speaks to your question, is how can people self-steer in that way? Like, how can we as a group, or how can I, let's start with an individual, it's already hard enough. How can I as an individual notice and then act upon my sense of whether this is right now a good moment for rounds, or whether we can just decide not to do rounds right now? Like, basically, anything that comes from a book and anything that would be ideal will eventually be rigid and dogmatic, and I don't want that. So that means now we need to empower people to self-discern whether this is a good idea right now. And that's, of course, really hard and messy because then all our biases and blah, all of these things come in. But I think still what I want to do is empower people to make those choices themselves. One thing that I would just want to flag, because it adds a whole level of complexity to the whole situation, is we're not only asking individuals to do that kind of discernment and acting according to the balance of the dynamic balance of whatever they want or see fit in the moment for whatever they want to do, but now we're asking groups to monitor that together and then decide upon. Because it might be, for example, that I say, let's do rounds because I really want to be heard. And you say, no, screw rounds. We need to get this thing done. Then how will we decide how we will even talk about this? So there's just a lot of complexity in navigating the space as a group with the expectation that we can do it together. And sociocracy has some of the solutions, but a lot of it is also just a toolbox, and we need to at the same time train people on, okay, what tool do you use for what and for how long? And when do you give up and try a new tool? And that's hard. That's really mind-blowingly hard to do and to teach. So that's something I'm paying attention to very much.
Yeah, I like your answer. It's very real. And I like also that you said it's a toolbox, right? So It's great if you have many different tools in the toolbox, but you still got to know how to use them and when to use which one, right? It's exciting because, you know, I think when I hear the word governance, of course, my mind goes to groups, my mind goes to organizations, but then ultimately, in one way or other, and our conversation already kind of went down that track as well, it comes back to the individual and the individual's ability to make sovereign decisions and the individual's ability to ask questions in a way that lead to the answers we actually want to pursue, right? Because it's really easy to get lost. It's really easy to get lost in one's own mind. It's really easy to just kind of go down a track that doesn't actually allow you to progress. Where do you think that the topic of self-sovereignty and just being able to really stand in one's own truth, where does that play a role here, and how do you help that when you work with groups, organizations, or teams, so that people really feel like they're fully taken as they are, but also they got to take themselves as they are. They can't just lean on the group to understand who they are, right? Like, this is an interesting feedback loop we have between me knowing who I am and the group telling me who I am. I mean, there's a bit of both in it, but the topic of self-sovereignty is something we've been tracking in this podcast for many years, and I think it is. It's essential.
Yeah, very much so. Hold on, I have so many notes already on this one. This is also something that shows up for me a lot. So I want to, I guess, just report a little on how I approached it in my latest book, Collective Power, because one of the main pieces about that is that what I'm doing in that book is I'm looking at basically all the different levels and seeing what the emergent properties are around governance and agency, collective agency, basically around like on these different levels, starting with the individual, but then going to teams pretty quickly, because individuals for me in the context of the book are really only relevant on the team level. So, but what shows up is what you, I guess, call self-sovereignty, but I was more going in the direction, but I think we're talking about something very similar, responsibility, right? So, because, so what I'm saying there is that responsibility, basically, or stepping into your own responsibility, having kind of your action fully fill and not overblow, but also not fully not fully fill your sphere of influence, basically. So are you actually making use of all the agency that you have? If you don't, I would call it power under. So that's when you have power, but you're not using it. You're just complaining, for example. Like, for example, for those who know the drama triangle, that's kind of the victim position, right? When you have agency, but you don't claim it. And there's a lot of that happening. And then there's the opposite of overstepping into other people's sphere, and that's power over, right? And then ideally, if everybody has claims exactly the level of agency they have, and not more and not less, you know, with some room for error, of course, we end up in a system that now empowers power with. So people need to step into their agency, but that just leads to a set of individuals that are primed to collaborate. What we then need is the governance on the team and the organizational level. So basically, a well-adjusted human being, to use that term, and I don't really like it, but just as a shortcut, is basically the building block that we need for teams and for organizations. Just like we need well-adjusted teams that step into the agency fully is the building block for organizations. So it kind of just cascades. It's like a domino effect. And we all know that effect. It's very obvious. If somebody, let's say you have a team where somebody is struggling heavily, okay, then that will get the whole team, like the whole team would come to screeching halt, right? So basically, all the levels build on each other, and if you don't have individuals that are ready, there will be less attention that they can pay to the levels that build on that. So that's, yeah, and really you can see it in all the different ways. Like you can also have an organization where one team is constantly complaining and kind of taking that victim position, right? And that also messes everything up, because then everybody gets ready to play the drama along, right? And rescues and like all of that. Anyway, that's a whole other topic. So the interesting question for me, and that says one other piece for me, and that is the how to help with that. Because I think it's, again, a dualism that I struggle with, although I'm using it because I think it's useful to have that distinction and discern of, like, this is an individual responsibility, just do it, please. You know, there's the team, that's ours, that's the organization, how is that held? It's interesting, or it's good to know that. And on the other hand, of course, it's also ridiculous to think that an individual exists without its context. So that's, yeah, so we... but just so relational that is not even a unit that makes sense. Like, for example, if you look at pro-social and their work, they're saying an individual is not a useful unit to look at for humans. It's more like bees. You can't understand how bees work if you only look at one bee. In the same way, you can't understand humans if you only look at one human. When that's not a useful unit, given how collaborative and social we are. So in a way, so I'm using it as a crutch to kind of get the point across, also knowing that one really should also hold that lightly, because otherwise I think one misunderstands how humans function.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it we are a collective species, and separation has kind of, you know, has its thread through almost all of our systems in the modern world. And at the same time, you know, as your book says, there's many voices to the one song, right? And the universe. Ted, I'd love to kind of backtrack in your story a little bit and get some, you know, maybe personal stories or memories on how this all started for you. Because I remember reading online that it started in a co-housing community, right? And so I'd love to take what we shared so far into the most real examples, right, where people can actually see themselves in, or maybe resonate with and realize, like, yep, I've been in this situation, or yep, that came up. If it's back in university days or in a modern co-housing community setting, or in a, you know, kind of a community space anywhere in the world. But I think it happens in those spaces. So what are your stories, and where was that aha moment where you're like, I'm going to start writing books about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, so yes, I moved into this community that was at that point in time adopting Sociocracy. So I didn't bring it here, but it was already here and I accounted it here. And then I got interested in that and helped the person who brought it here. It was my colleague, Jerry Coates Gonzalez. I helped him start Sociocracy for All. So we co-founded that. The reason for me was, I mean, like everybody, I've had a bunch of bad experiences. Like one of them that really stuck with me because I remembered being very angry about it, or feeling like I had been used for something that I really didn't want to participate in. And it was a participatory process where people, so I was on the team that was building like a summer academy kind of a thing. And we were soliciting proposals, and then the membership was supposed to vote on them. And the idea was to keep up quality, that half of the proposals would be accepted so that it's going to be good quality, right? And that makes sense. All of the pieces, when you look at them, make sense. Like, yes, members should totally vote, of course. Yes, of course, we're only going to accept the best proposals. But sitting in it, you know, it all made sense until I sat there and was like, this feels so fundamentally wrong. I will never do this again. I'm complicit in something that is so wrong. It would make me nauseous. And why did it feel wrong? First of all, the people who voted had no clue what they were voting on. They were just voting on some, you know, they were just taking the headlines going like, that sounds cool, I'm for it. You know, they had no idea what was underneath. We knew because we had interacted with those people offering the
vote. Sounds like politics.
Yes. Yeah. Voting is superficial and it's maddening. And, you know, and it's one thing to say, oh, you know, politics is bad, but you're not in it. But I was co-responsible. And that's why it hurt so much. I was doing the thing that I disliked when others did it. The other piece that really got to me was the fact that I was one of the people who solicited proposals with people who put their heart into it. And then we said, oh, sorry, to keep up quality, we have to reject half of them. That's complete nonsense. That's like producing, you know, that's overproduction and then producing waste. Like, why would we do that? And why did it pull me in to do that? So I was really like, I was disgusted actually with it, honestly. So that was one of the things. I remember discussing, you know, growing up in Germany, as I know you did, just all the different discussions and all the different things about, like, you know, wrestling with Holocaust history of how can one make sure one doesn't become a part of that? Because it could be any ideology that pulls you in. That was at least my sense as a teenager of like, shit, if you believe in anything, you can be pulled in to notice the humongous, humongous shadow. I mean, of course, some shadows are more obvious than others. And yet, everything comes with a shadow. So that just seemed dangerous to be invested in anything. And then what helped me in sociocracy was just how genuinely it was doing the multi-perspective piece. And the fact that it was tying together collective responsibility with individual responsibility. So it just has more safety measures against any of those. It produces less waste. I guess just all the things we got like, okay, now I don't feel disgusted at myself for operating with other people, right? Now it seems like I'm actually nourishing and feeding myself with what's happening here. So it was really mostly a heart decision for me. There was also another interesting piece that I only rarely speak about, but it's... you know, there's the impact back from the community into the person, right? When you're kind of confronted with being asked to show up again and again. One of the things that happened for me early in my sociocracy story was that I came out as transgender, right? Because I could not, like, it was, then it happened actually around work. The first time I remember having the thought was in a moment where I was presenting and I was just realizing, wait, like, I'm talking about all these things, but I'm not living it, you know, like, I'm not being true to myself. And it just became a cognitive dissonance I could not escape anymore. So that I really credit that, like, I there is an obvious connection for me to the work that I was doing and what was happening for me personally.
Yeah, that last line there is when, no matter what the personal topic is, but when we realize we're not actually authentically embodying who we are, or who, you know, I am as an individual in the feedback loop of the whole. But that's where the disconnect actually begins. I think there's, you know, probably 8 billion people on the planet, or 7.5 or something now. And I don't think any of them really individually would love to live on a polluted world full of trash if we were to individually ask them. But our own participation in that is kind of where to reconcile it, right? And then at the same time, especially with trash, I just jumped there in terms of topic, but it's such a big one. It's so hard to understand how to actually meaningfully participate, right? You mentioned overproduction there in your share as well, where It's like, well, why would we do this? It makes no sense to overproduce and then throw things away. But somehow that is the world we live in. And so I'm curious between, you know, your own journey and how you reached that place, and then, you know, the governance of groups, how do you see that scale into a meaningful way where people can actually, you know, maybe not feel like they're just being decided for in the outer world, but through the process of self-sovereignty, understanding who I am as an individual in the field, the feedback loop of the group, and then also applying certain, you know, tools and tricks out of the toolbox and meaningfully changing the world, not just for a political conquest of like, this is my opinion and I want everyone to see and understand my opinion, but for things that actually impact our life, right? In a way that I think many people listening to it have that feeling that the world is changing. The world is changing faster than ever. And maybe there is a doomsday kind of vision in front of us, but that's just not the direction it has to unfold. There's so much more possible as people come together. And that's what I kind of see in your topic of expertise there, Ted, is this, you know, this collaborative power of humans coming together, making smart choices together, making choices together because they listen to everyone in the decision-making unit, right? So I kind of went all over the board there, but my question basically is like, how to scale governance systems like sociocracy in a meaningful way, and how to tackle really big problems with it, like let's say pollution, or you know, the picture of trash that our planet is facing, because it's real, right?
Yeah, there was a lot here. Okay, let me see where I can start. So one thing I want to say is, just speaking to the doomsday part, because it was actually out of all people, because we've already brought it up, it was Otto Scharmer who just recently actually snapped me out of that, because he was reflecting on my, or in response to my pessimism about everything, kind of calling me on my own sense of agency, right? And there we are right on topic again. I was like, wait, Ted, you know, you're giving away agency because people like me, you know, I mean, I have kind of, I want to say, above average leverage to change things around governance, how things are working on the planet around governance. Like, okay, so what am I doing with it, right? It's like, wow, I had forgotten about that. Like, you know, I was in pity mode, self-pity mode, when I talked to him. And that ended quickly because he was absolutely right. So the thing that I do personally with it, and then I'll speak to scale, is, you know, trash, it's funny that you bring it up, because trash is, I think, the thing where I think about it the most. I mean, there's a zillion places to think about it, but every time I put something into the trash, I imagine myself having the conversation with my grandchildren who ask me, how could you think that's okay? And I would, you know, each time I have this mini conversation of like, yeah, I knew each time it wasn't okay. I knew it each time. Like, and then, you know, they would look at me with big eyes, is what I'm imagining. And like, how could you live with so much cognitive dissonance? And I'd say, yeah, I don't know. It wasn't fun, that I can tell you, you know. But I don't know. But one of the things I want to say is there is a really helpful notion, and I don't want to, there's a tricky balance to make here. Because, you know, on the one hand, I want to live in a world where we're not producing any trash. On the other hand, I also want to not go into this very antagonistic sense of, you know, like idealism versus kind of pragmatism, because again, I want to integrate them. It's about good enough. And that's a big frame in sociocracy, right? And the related tools of what's the good enough solution, and then negotiating that instead of blaming each other on both sides and saying, well, you're naive, well, you're producing trash. So what is good enough? Like, what, given my agency, what is the good enough given where I am? And that is the question I try to answer. It's still a hard one, but it's not as unanswerable as the other ones. So that's my personal answer to that. Did you want to say more on that one? Otherwise, I would go into...
No, I mean, it's just such an interesting one. I really like where you went from idealism, pragmatism, right? Because idealism in itself, without any grounding, is just... like, why even have the conversation, right?
Right.
But then, pragmatically, with trash, I can't solve it today alone. I just can't. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean I'll be in a pessimist mood about it personally, but I just won't be able to solve it. And there is a part of it where I have to come to terms with that. Even if I were a zero waste advocate and would do this perfectly, I would still not solve it, right?
Yep.
So that's where it gets very, very, it's like boxes and boxes and boxes of complication, right? It's so complex, and it's like a Russian doll. When you take off the first layer, there's another layer, and then there's another layer, and then there's another layer.
Right. I mean, in this world, you can't even be a good person if you use a computer, or like, you know, a good person. I use it kind of as a label, right? You can't be a good person if you own a cell phone. End of story. So we all know we're already not good people. So, okay, now that we've accepted that and we've really looked that in the eye, now what's next? And also just one comment on the idealism, completely agreeing with you, is idealism is detached from doing. Because idealism, and that's, again, something that I noticed in writing Collective Power, and it's somewhat in there, it's just about realism means, or it comes with resource constraint. That is... resource constraint is a fact of life, right? It's just that's and any evolutionary process is in that push and pull between those two poles, right? Of something that wants to happen, but there's resource constraint. So this is not something that we can kind of idealize away. Or I think actually I've flipped it for myself. I think there's a lot of grace in that actually. It's actually really beautiful because it also sparks all the creativity of like, okay, how can I make do with what I have? Or back to the agency piece, given that this is my sphere of influence, what can I do within that sphere of influence? So it can spark creativity, innovation, but also kind of bring us back to our agency. Because, for example, if you have a circle that is not really paying attention to their aim, then they're just spinning their wheels. I have a tiny little story on that I just find super informative. It really brought that home for me. So it was in a workshop. I was teaching sociocracy. And we had a little aim around our workshop, like learning and experiencing sociocracy on the Saturday morning kind of a thing. And then we had worked around a certain proposal. And then this person, it was around baby noises, which is too long of a story, but that's what it was about because there was a baby in the workshop and I'm hard of hearing. So we tried to kind of manage that. And that was our practice proposal. And then a person got completely ticked off and stood up and gave a speech about how mainstream is not good to children and not good to humans and shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't treat people like that, blah, 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 blah. Went on and on and on and on. And I said, wow, I absolutely agree with you. Now tell me what that means for our workshop, our aim for us right now. And the person said, oh, this is just for right now. Oh, for right now, it's totally fine. It's like, there we go. Because that's all we're doing. We're just solving today. So I see that a lot, that groups just give away their agency because they talk about the things they can't change. And then they do not do the things that they can change. And I have a little bit of beef with that, honestly, because it's easy to be the good person if you only talk about the big problems that you're not going to solve anyway, right? But I want to actually have that full match between my agency of things that I can do and the doing of it and not be detached from it. And that's really something that I hold very, very firmly.
That's huge. And ultimately that's a pretty accurate answer to how to scale anything, is to activate more people into participation, the participation based on the agency of what they can do today, right? Which over time might stack and build momentum and it becomes more, right? In terms of what you can do as an individual. But it also is, I think that's where our superpower of collaboration actually is kind of housed or homed in, is in this experience of understanding all of it I could never do alone. I will need other people for that. And so empowering and encouraging all individuals to unpack their uniqueness and to deploy their uniqueness and to activate that uniqueness and participate in the game of life, I think is actually really the path, you know? It's the way that we come into a, you know, a coherent song. And within that, I think there's very likely I use the word uniqueness for a reason. I think there's a lot of room for everyone to do this however they uniquely see fit, which I think is still something very, very, it's like a delicate topic in our modern society, is we're craving for diversity and uniqueness, but then it also looks like we're doing that in such a such a difficult way where unless you agree with everything I say, then maybe you're wrong or a bad person, as he said, not a good person. And I don't think that that's actually even necessarily, I mean, it matters, but I don't think it necessarily matters for our personal agency. How do you see that coming back to personal agency?
Which piece of, say it again so that it really answer to what you wanted.
Yeah, no, so what I mean is
the end.
Our opinions and ideas about what others should and shouldn't do.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You know, I think that that is ultimately, I mean, to a degree, it's none of my business. And to a degree, I just want others to feel the best, most grounded version of themselves they can be, no matter what they choose, as long as it's not hurting a third person. But I want them to participate in life. I want people to wake up and show up and you know, as you know, Otto Scharnier kind of did with you, is like snap out of the pessimism and act in the agency that they have available today.
Yeah, that is a tricky one around the, like, when is it my responsibility to show up? We have this on a small scale in this community. I think that's a nice and tangible example of, so we're like 70 people living together, right? What if a couple gets divorced? Is that their private business or is it a community business? And that's constantly a struggle because, of course, when people are in pain, they kind of contract, right? So now they want to say, like, leave me alone, don't talk to me. You know, this is our own thing. We're on it. Thank you. When really it's the whole community that's hurting. And I always, like, I am always on the side of, like, no, this is community business. This is, like, at least a part of it is community business because we're together here. Whenever I see you, you know, like, it impacts me when you get divorced, you know. It impacts me. It impacts the field if any two people aren't on speaking terms or whatever there might be. So there is something there. But then there is, yeah, how much can we push? So that's a really difficult question. The one thing that I want to bring up, and it's kind of an indirect answer, I'm aware of that. I'm not really answering your question because I think this balance is kind of, I don't know where to put the right balance here. But one thing that I want to do is, so you spoke earlier to kind of individual empowerment or like, yeah, that in my words, individual agency. And that is the building block. I'm absolutely with you. And I want to also add that there is such a thing as, you know, group dynamics and systems, how systems behave, that are more than the sum of their parts. So I also, I guess I, you know, as we all know, there's this whole narrative around climate, for example, that it's all about individual responsibility. And I don't want to fall prey to that because that is unseeing systems. So just wanting to bring that up, I'm sure I'm in alignment with you.
Yeah, that's a great example to point at. Is where it blames the individual without taking the systems or the systemic root cause into the equation. And that's, you know, it comes back, our entire conversation is this dance with dualism, right? Like how to outdance dual thinking and kind of reach the place of paradox where it paradoxically can both be true and then you reach non-dualism where it's like, okay, there's a next step to take for me here today or for us as a group here today.
And so if we only look at individual systems or individuals with their own agency, then we don't see the systems that they're part of. And that is a piece that we need to bring in. And that also, by the way, speaks to the scale question, because I think scale means kind of looking at the emergent properties on all of the different levels, right? Individuals need to be ready, but then also organizations need to have a shape and form that works with that. And then the systems that are bigger than that, like nation states, if we even need nation states. One thing that we run into on scale, and that's the one comment I want to make on scale, because it's a little bit of an unsolved problem for me, and I'd be happy for people to help me solve it. And it is that if I am, let's say I'm part of a bunch of sociocratic organizations who have a say, or whatever system they have, but they're participatory and have a say. So my community, my family, my workplace, let's say my kid's school, and something else. I already noticed that my bandwidth is maxed out with the two things that are sociocratic may have a say. I don't have a say in the school, and I'm really happy with that because I do not even read their emails. Because I have too many, like it's just too much. So if I imagine also needing to have a say in my bank and in my food corp and then the CSA and so on, I'm overwhelmed just thinking about that one. So I think we need to partially also just let go of our expectation of participation. There's something inherently wrong, I think, about wanting tons of participation in all of our lives, like in all parts of our lives. I don't think that doesn't work and it doesn't scale. So there's some logical error there that I can't resolve somehow. It's just not possible. So we run into the constraint again that is bandwidth in our case. So that's bandwidth.
That constraint is very real. I feel like our conversation is kind of full circle at where we kind of started, which is, you know, there's a logical paradox that shows up when we are too much in dualistic thinking. If it's polarities and two sides, then at some point you reach the paradox, which is usually when you know something really juicy is about to unfold, and we kind of enter that non-dual place where, you know, in terms of your last comment there, I agree. I don't want to participate in all of the consensus making of my bank or my food corp or whatever. However, I would like to trust the people that do. And so that currency of trust is currently in this current reality. I mean, I don't know. I do trust a bunch of people, but I don't trust quite every organization, because most of them, you can see the shady operations. You mentioned the cell phone earlier. Just by owning a cell phone, we kind of are, you know, covertly saying that's okay how we get those minerals out of the ground and how the data is being harvested. And really, we know that's not a sustainable long-term situation, right? And so we have a lot of these paradoxical problems in our world still, and I don't think they're all solved today. I really enjoyed this conversation with you, Ted, and feel like we're just scratching the surface. So maybe we'll have to have you back for a longer one or 2.0, where we go deeper into, you know, some of those topics. Thank you so much for being on Green Planet, Blue Planet today. Is there anything you want to close the episode with? Anything you want to make sure you mention or you say?
Well, just on that last note of coming back, as I think I've mentioned, I am very actively thinking about overcoming that dualism and thinking more about the integration. So I'm very actively doing thinking and reading and studying on that one. So if anybody hears this and goes like, "Ooh, I have just a thing for Ted," please do contact me. And I'm happy to report back in, I don't know, a few months or however long it takes to share what I found. Because a lot of it also has to do with, you know, like all the sense making. Occasions like this one is one of those areas of sense making, right? Where the two of us are making sense, then people hear it and we have to close the feedback loop again, so that then all the things, like, we're moving forward in sort of the same conversation, just in a very, very many different places. That's what I'm hoping for. So feel free to contact me.
Beautiful. Thank you, Ted.